Start by telling us a little bit about what you do.
Well, we run what's effectively an internet company. It started a very long time ago as an ISP. And over time, that ISP got bigger and bigger. It was at a time when people really did start discovering the net in the old dial-up days. And that eventually became a public company. It was merged with another South Australian company. We did the public company thing in 2000. And then I decided a few years later that we really wanted to get back to basics in regional areas. And so we started a consultancy. But that consultancy then became more hands-on in terms of helping people connect to the cloud and collect to the internet. So in a way, we kind of came back full circle. We went very big and then we went small again. And now we provide cloud-based services in our own data center and connectivity. And we look at the strategic side of things in regional Victoria as well. You know, so it's not just about the technical stuff. It's looking at the strategic impact on regional communities and how the internet affects them and what benefits they have when they do have it and the disadvantages they have when they don't have it. So a lot of those things roll themselves into one. But a lot of it is about helping small business, making sure that we have virtualized systems for medical specialists, and ensuring that you know, people can use the technology without having to be, you know, befuddled by it. You get to use it, we get to run it for you. So things like that.
The topic of this interview is data democracy. But first of all, a bit of background. There's a lot of talk about how we're in the era of big data.
Yes.
What does that actually mean?
Well, it means that over time, people, I mean, historically it was about the fact that mainframe computers and others produced logs. And, you know, those logs contained a lot of information about how those computers were performing. And over time, that information became more and more useful. And then, you know, rather than the computers telling them or users how in those logs how the computer was going, how are other systems going, et cetera, et cetera. So that data started to build up. And I think people in the stats world started to say, well, if we can collect all that data and analyze it, that's a really good thing. So, you know, the old famed L-shaped spreadsheets came along and lots of data was collected on that basis. And I think there was an increasing understanding that if you have raw data sets, then, you know, there's many, many things that you can do. And historically, I mean, this is how science has been run for a very long time anyway, but the advent of computers and the access to computers have meant that, you know, collection of data has almost become trivial. And over time, you know, businesses have started to develop a thirst and an understanding for the fact that the more they know about their markets, the more they know about their products and their services, the easier it is to sell. So from a commercial point of view, there was a great deal of that as well. And of course, we learned a great deal during conflict, you know, during the wars and, you know, the collection of intelligence, you know, and the collation of that intelligence, the secret intelligence of that, and the analysis of all of that, you know, became part and parcel of what the intelligence services did. And that, unfortunately, is one of the darker sides of big data because it's pervaded, you know, society since then. So the growth of that data is really about what advantage can we get about understanding what we do and what is it in terms of that raw information that can be used. And I think it's fair to say that the larger the data set and the longer it's been collected, the more precious it becomes. And, you know, the ability to do empirical analysis now is almost taken for granted, provided the data's been collected. And that's something that we're seeing an increasing amount of now.
So when we say there's a lot more data, what are we talking about? What does it look like? What sort of information is now being collected that wasn't before?
Well, in many cases, it may just be ones and zeros. You know, everything now, the Internet of Things is a great contributor to this now. Everything from, you know, minute by minute temperatures of a certain patch of land to, you know, air temperature qualities and other apparently trivial things like how many cars have gone across a particular piece of road, automated processes now, and the movement of people. I mean, it is possible, for instance, to count the movement of people through a particular gate. just with using very low-level sensors now. And that sort of process gets put into big data banks. And, you know, we can decide what we do with it afterwards, but effectively those sorts of things are now multiplying on a daily basis. So, you know, I think it's very hard to measure how much there is, but we probably produce more data as opposed to information per day than was ever produced in the entire history of mankind prior to the introduction of computers. You know, so there is a very large amount of sometimes complex, sometimes simple data, and the quantity of the data, if it can be stored, and that's another issue, is almost immeasurable these days.
And why do you contrast or make a distinction between data and information?
Well, I think, you know, I think it's readily accepted in some circles that the data is pretty useless until you do something with it. You know, and even, you know, raw spreadsheets. If you look at raw spreadsheets, you can see the numbers, but not necessarily glean anything from it. There has to be an ability to use that data in a way that answers questions. And raw data of itself won't answer those questions. You have to collate, you know, the analysis of that data in a way that allows people to see certain things that they are looking for. So if, and again, probably a good example is that if you have a certain temperature and a certain moisture or humidity in the air, in soil, for instance, then the bits and pieces of information about humidity, temperature, you know, and the dryness of the soil, et cetera, may not of their own mean anything, but if you combine them together, you know, the piece of information that comes out of the combination of analysing that data gives farmers an ability to say, now may be a good time to plant my seeds. You know, but any one individual piece of data itself doesn't actually do that. You know, so it's a matter of extracting knowledge and information from the raw pieces that you have that allow you to make, if you like, produce other data which happens to be informative. It tells you something, it's meaningful, rather than just a number about a certain thing at a certain time in a certain place.
And you mentioned before the Internet of Things. Mm. What does that mean and why is that important in this data?
Well, again, we talk about the proliferation of data. Again, in an analogy, prior to you know, the proliferation of these little things, and you know, everything is something connected to the Internet these days, it was a matter of people going out there doing a particular activity to collect the data and then bringing that data back, extracting it from wherever it needed to be extracted, analyzing it and then producing it in a way that's useful. It used to be very expensive to do that. These days you can get a little $20 chip that's Wi-Fi enabled and it may have a number of different sensors on it. You can put it somewhere and you can quite literally automate that little thing's actions. So it not only collects the data, but also transmits it back to a specified database and may even do some preliminary number crunching on it. So it may run algorithms so you get not just data, but information coming out of it. And it's live and it's real time. Now, if you have one of those, that's a lot of data. If you have 200 of them on a particular paddock or in a particular room or on a particular machine, then you are flooding a machine with lots and lots of raw data. And little IoT devices can do that sort of thing. It cuts down the time, it cuts down the cost. It means that rather than having to go out to a particular place, this thing is transmitting 24/7. And in terms of the actual configuration of these little devices, some of them can actually be programmed in the cloud. So the device might sit there and say, what would you like me to be today? And then you go onto a web page, you reprogram it on the web page, and you send that configuration back down to the sensor, and it'll do something completely different that day. And that could be that, you know, that sensor could be in a bore in the middle of regional Victoria, and you could be at Fed Uni in Mount Helen, or you could be in Germany, or you could be on the ISS. You know, it doesn't matter where you are, so long as you can get a signal through the internet to that particular device. So all of a sudden, data can be collected from anywhere, from any place, to anywhere, to any place. And even that, you know, produces its own data as well. So the process of analysis of what comes out of these devices is becoming easier. The question is, what is the value of that data to the people who want to use it? And that's a huge question.
how do we even start to evaluate the value of the data?
Well, I think there are some pretty obvious signs. I mean, to start with, we are moving towards this big data, open data regime within the government. And I think we've well proven that if certain amounts of data that the government collects, you know, statistical data about populations, technical data about weather, or data about how houses are being built, where they're being built, et cetera, et cetera. The amount of information that the government collects is almost limitless. If you take that data, one of the things that we've found is that government isn't necessarily good at using the data or actually exploiting what it's collected. And so many organisations, including our own, have said, well, why don't you open it up to people who might be able to do something valuable with it? And I suppose for us, the archetypal example of somebody doing something really crazy but useful are the GovHack competitions that we run. So the government says, we don't quite know what you're going to get out of this data, but what we're going to do is we're going to expose it to you, and you're going to have 48 hours to do something really cool with it. You know, here's some outcomes that we think we might get, but we don't know how to do it. So a lot of these imaginative programmers and other types, because they're not restricted to programmers, come along and they say, all right, let's take that data set, but you know what, let's take another data set and let's overlay one on top of the other. In many cases, governments haven't thought about doing that. And that matrix produces some very unique vision into what is happening in a particular place. Because when you collect all that data and start comparing it and putting it in one place, it starts painting pictures in different ways. And that ability to paint a picture and tell a story, I think, is one of the key aspects of data analysis in these days. The fact of the matter is that we talk about data democracy. Data is only useful if it's accessible. And you need to ask what audience you are addressing and in what form that data will be producing information that can be presented to that audience. And I'd have to say that it is probably a very difficult thing for the person on the street to understand how such an inordinately large and complex massive data can be of any value whatsoever. So the bit in between, the bit that democracy, the data democracy concept requires, is a truthful, articulate, and clever storyteller or a picture painter. And those are the data analysts. Those are the people that come around and say, well, look, okay, we've got a bit of data over there and a bit of data over there. How about we bring them together to see if we can form a picture? And the important part about that is, firstly, the data has to be integral. It has to be consistent. So if you're taking two sets of data and they analyze or they record the same piece of data in a different way, then you need to reconcile what it looks like. But the second thing is that we need to understand that when we put those two things together, that the storyteller is actually telling us something accurate. You know, we've heard of all of the fake news and all of the things that we've argued about climate change. The deniers say that there's evidence in the numbers that say that it's not, we're not going through climate change. And the scientists are saying, well, yes, we are. Here's the evidence. And the public is in the middle saying, who do we believe? So while there are scientific facts there, the extraction of information from data is very much about the integrity of the people who are doing the extraction and doing the analysis in that process. And I think that forms a significant part of democracy, especially for those who do not have that technical capability to do so.
So how do you define data democracy?
I think it's a measured access, not just to the data, but the information that comes out of it. It's the old story that you can blind them with bullshit, you know. And of course, you can end up in a situation where let's not hide the data, but let's flood the public with data to the point where nobody's going to know which way is up. So data democracy, I think, is a discrete exercise and a measured one. And it needs to be looked at in the way that says it will be useful to people to understand the world or the environment that they're living in. So if we talk about urban data, I mean, quite clearly what the public expects a government to do is to plan intelligently in terms of those communities. This isn't a technical thing, it's a social thing. And people need to live in safe environments and environments that are conducive to growth and to safety and to and to having families and to having access to transport and access to services. There's a trust factor that says that the data that's produced about how these things are growing and will grow will be provided to make sure that those benefits occur. And so the government departments have a huge responsibility to ensure that that sort of thing happens. Independent organisations should be able to get access to it. So if you're planning something for a government project, or if you're planning an estate, then you should expect to be able to get the best data available, including things like whether or not there is soil contamination and those sorts of things. And if there is soil contamination, what intelligence have you got to say how long that soil contamination will be there and whether or not it needs to be removed or whether it can be buried, you know, in a concrete cask or something like that. And with that information, you can optimise on cost, which ultimately goes back to the consumer or the resident in that area. So there's a complex process there in terms of that side of things. The other side of things is that not all data should be free. There is some data that needs to be kept private. We all understand a sense of privacy. And certainly as time has gone by and as the governments of the world have become more interested in personal data and what it can tell them, I think the citizens of the world should be rightly concerned about how that data is being interpreted. One of the most recent arguments that we've had in Australia, for instance, is the compulsory collection by carriage service providers or internet service providers and telcos of what we call metadata. And there was an interesting experiment by a journalist who said, well, I'm going to put all my metadata out there and I'm going to ask people to comment on what they think I've been doing. And what was interesting was that while the metadata was accurate, a lot of people came to some very strange conclusions about his movements. You know, there was one particular case where they looked at these people looked at his phone data and saw that there were no phone calls being made on the evening of New Year's Eve until the next day, and everybody assumed that he was out partying. So the conclusion was out partying, going crazy, and stuff like that. Because he was a reporter, he was on duty. And he had been on duty for 2 days. He actually left the office late, went to sleep, didn't get up till later. But the natural assumption was party. In that circumstance, the inferences that can be drawn from things that are very innocent are things that we need to guard against. In the area of refugees and people who migrate to this country from politically sensitive countries, it's well known by the government that sometimes the exposure of data about cohorts and about the nature of people living in places, even though it's anonymized, may in itself give an indicator of where those people live and put them in, you know, in potential danger. So data democracy is about as much of releasing data, but it's equally about knowing which data might not be constructive and might not be useful and might in fact be dangerous if it's released. Where that line draws is very difficult to know. And it is a matter of circumstance. And again, if you think about the storytellers and the data analysts and the people who paint the picture, they have extraordinary responsibilities to look at all of those contexts. So it's not just a technical exercise. It's not just a matter of saying, well, if I take these two data sets and I combine them and I analyze them with these algorithms and I get this information, it's about what will this information do to the community and how will it affect individuals if it is released? You know, and is it something that we should do? And if not, is there certain amounts of data that we can remove to ensure that this doesn't happen? And again, I don't know how you would legislate for something like that. I don't know how you can put a blanket discretion on things like that. I think it's very much a matter of trusting people who are A, the data custodians, and B, the ones that do the analysis and the storytelling and the picture painting.
You've painted this complex world where there are both risks and benefits.
Yes.
What to you are the biggest risks of this new data landscape?
I think that the biggest risks are a lack of checks and balances. I think that it's already been proven that the old cliche that power corrupts absolute, power corrupts absolutely. You know, the power to collect data in, you know, detailed formats about all aspects of your lives presents both an opportunity and a threat. The opportunity in the sense that if we understand things like what causes cancer and where and those sorts of things, you know, getting medical data from GPs and working out the incidences, that's a really good thing. Really bad thing is that if you collect that personal data, then, you know, governments are able to track your every movement and to work out, you know, exactly how you live your life. And the question is, what is the purpose of doing that? And I think it's fair to say that there is a very real and tangible sense of distrust about governments who do not necessarily understand the moral and ethical dimensions of doing that sort of data analysis and putting out information or using information about us that we don't necessarily know about. The privacy legislation is very important in this country, but I still don't think that it has the ability, you know, to protect us in the way that it needs to. And I think there are a lot of people concerned about the fact that, on the one hand, the government wants to keep this data secret, even though it's open data. On the other hand, we're saying, well, look, you need to be open about the data. So there are two different levels of where that occurs. And just knowing that there's data there about you may be enough to say, well, I don't like that, and I'd like to report it to somebody. The fact that, you know, we have extreme cases like the NSA and other spy agencies that collect information and actually tap into machines, you know, in a way that neither governments nor, you know, certainly the community have authorized, sanctioned or approved of, produces data in a way that we think is really quite destructive to the fabric of society. And that needs to be looked at in context. You know, we understand all of the arguments about terrorism and stopping theft and crimes and things like that. But the reality is that it's a fairly blunt instrument to say, well, we're going to just access all of the personal data and work it out. I think that the encroachment on valid rights is not just about a philosophical thing. You know, there is genuine danger in the storytellers within government and the picture painters in government not necessarily understanding what they're doing. And that produces huge dangers for society and the communities that live in it.
So how do we mitigate against the, you know, how do we make sure those risks are managed? What do we need to do?
I think that we are going to, it's probably going to work, get worse before it gets better. I think that the concept of open data and big data within governments is relatively new. I think that in many cases, governments are still struggling with the level, the moral dimensions of what we do with data. I sometimes think that, again, there's this ability of saying, well, if people don't know, how is it going to hurt them? And the other side of things that you often hear from those more naive members of the community to say, well, if I haven't done anything wrong, why does it matter? The context, in, you know, and again, we need to go back to the fact that there is a very different attitude in Europe, for instance, where the paranoia that resulted from the terrible tragedies of World War II, you know, put privacy at the very front of people's thinking in legislative terms. I'm not saying that, that Europe is perfect either, but certainly even things like the English income the English Tax Act is schedularized, and the original theory of that was that one department never knew what the other department knew about different kinds of income. You know, whereas what we've got is a 1936 Income Tax Assessment Act, and the tax office knows everything. You know, so those are tiny examples of where there is a difference in attitude and a naivety about what it is that you're holding in your hands that can cause great concern. And I think there's also a generational issue where we've never been able to collect this data before. And we're now living in a world where this has been thrust upon people who were not brought up on the internet, who were not brought up with computers, and who simply think that so long as it's in their hands, it's going to be fine. But the problem is that when you put it in very large databases, and the purpose of having it in those databases is access, There is a lot in terms of layering of and controls of that process that don't necessarily always get done in the right way. So I think there's going to be a generation or two before we actually fully understand the implications of the personal side to that data. I think that at this point in time, there is a great deal of data that's coming out of government that should be released to the public because it helps us improve the way we live. It helps us improve the planning. Again, we go back to that question, who is the arbiter of what's good and what's bad? And I think that is a matter for public debate. I think it's a matter for finding those data analysts who have a conscience and who are articulate in understanding that process and developing those processes with the community. Because really, ultimately, the community needs to own those processes and own the arguments about what's good and bad for the community. And I don't know that either the community as an entirety is entirely articulate about that, and I certainly don't think government is either. So there's a way to go in terms of developing that process.
Yeah, indeed. And then there's also the private sector, which owns a lot of data too. So where does how does the private sector interact in that democratic space?
Again, with great difficulty, because part of the dilemma that private companies face is the fact that their interests are in commercial advantage. So collecting that data, as we've said before, assists them profitably in analysing how you shop, where you shop, those sorts of things. And we're all aware of the fact that things like concession cards that you, or the gift cards and the points cards that you can get for all sorts of things, they don't give you those points just to be grateful to you. They are doing data analysis on everything: where you bought, when you bought, how much you bought, possibly the context in which you bought it. So 3 o'clock in the morning, you bought donuts, from a petrol station. So there's a whole bunch of things in terms of user habits that can be taken into account, and that's pretty evident in the technologies that are used in on web pages, for advertising. People say to me, isn't it scary that they know what I was interested in and they pop up? Well, the technology is not all that difficult to do, actually, and it is easy to collect it. The question is not so much whether it's easy to collect, is what the responsibility is around it. And I think that commercial companies have started, ironically, they were the people that raised the alarm bells in the early days, if you like, because people were starting to suspect that we have become the product itself. So the data that people collect about consumers can be sold to other companies, and market analysis companies are famous for doing that sort of thing. So it's not only are we buying product, that we become the product as a result of the data that we produce of our own, not necessarily realizing that we're actually doing it. And I think there is an increasing conscience, within the community that credit cards and loyalty cards and those sorts of things are actually leaving a data trail, which is sometimes very hard to erase. And that's worth commercial value, but we don't necessarily get that value. You might have to buy several or the equivalent of several large cars before you get a free flight, but somehow we continue to do it, and that's a great concern.
So we've talked a little bit about the risks. What about the opportunities?
I think there's no question about the fact that data, in research at just about every single level is critical to the future of how we live, where we live, and how long we live. The amount of data that's been collected in the health field at the moment is going to make a difference in so many different ways. Things, and again, ironically, part of the problem of medical data being collected is that sometimes it's very difficult to actually bring it in one place. There are all these little domains and different ways of putting data together where they could be very useful if everybody agreed on the same format. And it would save lives. There's just been a discovery, for instance, of how you can stop a melanoma from growing. And a lot of that was data crunching. So information that's gathered from patients, put into a database, and the longer you have it, the more useful and accurate it becomes, can actually go to saving lives. We are already aware of the fact that the massive amount of data that's been collected about climate and climate change has had a significant effect on how scientists think about things like energy and how we produce energy and those sorts of things. And while some people might be skeptics, you know, the evidence that's been collected clearly indicates trends, and the value is amounting at all stages. You know, business planning. I mean, if you have really good intelligence about what you are doing in business and what sort of trending processes are concerned, not only can you make your business, you know, more efficient and more profitable, but you could actually employ more people. You know, and you know, in the whole area of agriculture, you know, one of the things that we're aware of is that, you know, the population of the planet is growing massively. The ability to be more efficient in how and when you plant crops and you rear cattle, you know, comes down to having masses of data about how deep the water goes down in your soil, when the water will be there, what happens if you have, you know, patches within a particular paddock or a particular field that are different. Can you do something differently with them? Whereas in the old days, you know, the idea that a farmer could just survey the land by looking at it, you know, very often cost them a lot of money. And, you know, the traditional farming processes like ploughing, sowing your seeds on Anzac Day, you know, usually result in the fact that if there were not optimal temperatures and environmental factors on that day, you were going to have to do it again. So if you have the data coming off the fields, and if you've collected over a period of time so you can see the cycles, you're likely to be more efficient in how you grow your crops. And if you are more successful and there is more food, you are likely to have what we consider to be better food security. And in terms of the returns to the farmer, obviously if he's spending or she's spending less on producing crops, then obviously the farmers are better off too. So there's a lot of trivial examples, but there's also a lot of significant examples, worldwide examples, where this sort of data analysis can make the difference between life and death. And the fact that we can do it with progressively smaller and smaller machines, more accessible machines, and with a proliferation of things that can take measurements of things, you know, IoT, very cheaply and trivially, but almost universally, means that we have a better understanding of our environment, a better understanding of the world in which we live in, and a better understanding how we impact on it and it impacts on us. And the only way we've been able to do that is to put in tiny little machines that produce that data, and we have then data analysis that can understand how to bring it together in a really useful way and tell that story.
So where would you like to see us in 10 years' time? Like, what's your vision in terms of how we can improve our data landscape?
Well, I think it's proved itself in a way. I mean, I think the issue is not so much proving the fact that data analysis and the collection of big data and the exposure of big data to the public in a measured circumstance that we've described is useful. I think it's a matter of articulating to government, you know, that level of understanding that it's actually a good thing for government to do it. I think there are good signs, but I don't think it's a universally accepted doctrine in terms of what can happen. The control factor of that information, I think, is partly driven by a generational thinking. I think it's also partly generated by a lack of understanding of what you have in your hands. So I think it's not so much a matter of improving the processes, but improving the thoughts, the thought processes and the attitudes of people about it. I think what we can do to demonstrate that is to continue to use open data in a very constructive fashion. And for universities and educational institutions to use it, you know, prolifically in terms of how they teach and what they teach and what they produce in their research, to show people exactly where these sorts of things become very useful. And it's the visualization of a lot of the data that is the most useful thing for the public. I mean, as we say, a picture paints a thousand words. And some of the geospatial data that gets put out can tell somebody immediately what an issue is, whereas going through large amounts of spreadsheets and numbers may take hours, if not days. So I think the proof is in the eating. But it's also the convincing at a political level This sort of science is a really good thing if it's done in the right circumstances and it's done in an open and accountable fashion. Because at the end of the day, we almost always have to trust the data. If we don't have integral sets of data, then we've got a problem. So if there is a challenge for the future, it is about maintaining that integrity, also getting agreements on the formats of the data. So if I say X, you mean X, and we both mean the same thing. And also protecting the data. Integrity is about making sure that it is safe and it isn't corrupted or it's not accessed and compromised. And that's now becoming a source of major concern. Right now it's in communications, but even the transmission of data needs to be looked at very carefully. And certainly global organizations like the Internet Society and the Internet Engineering Task Force believe that you need to encrypt everything. And again, that's not necessarily central to open data, but at the same time, in order to make sure that that repository of open data is safe, there must be safety mechanisms put together to make sure it remains integral and it remains useful.
Yeah, we haven't really touched on the security side. Do you want to talk about?
I think it's crucial. I mean, it's the old story that people believe what they're given, and. If we accept the fact that part of the growth of wanting more data and collecting more data, apart from the fact that you can collect it, is the ability to tell stories. It is entirely possible that if you create a complete set of fake data, that you will have a potential of having storytellers tell you completely fake stories and not know it. So the protection of that data, the integrity of the data, means it can't be corrupted, it can't be compromised, it can't be accessed, so people can change the data that's in those databases. And, you know, part of the cybersecurity issues right now are the fear that hostile countries won't attack you from the air or from the land, but they'll attack you through the internet. And a perfectly good way of doing that is to change all the parameters on which you are making your decisions. And if databases are substituted for ones that quite clearly draw you to the wrong decision, then that's something that comes down to a matter of national security.
Yeah, it's really important.
It is, and certainly in terms of things like electricity grids resources and essential services. Many of those services depend on understanding empirical patterns of usage and consumption and predictability. And certainly the issue about base loads and running out of power, you know, have depended on, you know, some assumptions about the data that's coming out about when it happens and how it happens. If in fact a foreign power decides to falsify that information, it could be a simple thing that an electricity company turns on what it thinks is going to be a surge, you know, runs out of what's known as dispatchable power, and then all of a sudden you have a blackout at an airbase or something like that. So there's a number of different, almost paranoid permutations of what false data can do, but I don't think it's so far removed from reality that we shouldn't bear any attention to it.
So you've said that in government circles, there's perhaps some decision makers don't understand what it is that they're sitting on.
No, I don't think there's a culture of understanding that.
What would you like to say to a decision maker in government who's in the position to enact change around data? What would you like to say to them?
It would have something to do with the laws of mathematics. I think what I'd like to say is that certainly, especially in terms of the more reticent of public servants when they look at that, is to say that you know, in terms of the efficiency of how you do things, you know, the data, if analysed properly, produces information on which you can base knowledgeable decisions, and decisions that are likely to be able to save you money and save the community money from that point of view. I think that it's a matter of trying to convince them by example that the visualization of data in many, many areas can assist in rapid decision making about how we best deploy our resources. And I think that the only way that you can do that is demonstrate it through research. Universities play a pivotal role in this, you know, to show how, apparently disparate pieces of data, you know, collected from areas where you wouldn't think they'd need to go together, can be combined in a matrix to produce some very valuable results. We've seen that in GovHack. It was interesting that the Dank report, which was on domestic violence, was in a PDF format. And one of the teams said, well, why don't we take that PDF format and try and convert it into something that is readable by a machine and analyzable. So they did. They actually scanned the data and they looked for geographic data, they looked for locational data, they looked for information about the types of incidences and what time they were and things like that. And then they said, well, that's very interesting, but how about we take data from some other databases that say where the essential services were and try and look at the difference between the two. And what they did was they overlaid it and they found out that the areas where domestic violence were high in Melbourne, services were somewhere else. And I thought that was really interesting because nobody had thought to actually sit down and do that. So they did. They produced a valuable result that that was picked up by the Premier's office. And you know, my understanding is that it's going to go further. So sometimes you get surprising results that assist you in the things that you want to do because you were not thinking laterally in terms of how that information goes together. And sometimes it's not your job to. Maybe it's the possibility that you, when you put that data out, other people will do it for you. And if it makes your life better, it must, as a public servant, it must make, you know, your stakeholders' lives better. And if, in fact, you get a more efficient outcome out of government as a result of that sort of ability to analyse laterally, if you like, think laterally about the information, then that's got to be a good thing. But I think that it's the old story of, well, you didn't used to do it that way, so how come it's different now? And, you know, perhaps it will be a case of a generational change. You know, there are now people in decision-making roles who were born with the internet facing them, you know, whereas in our generation, you know, of course, it was a new thing. So we now have a group of decision makers that will be going through the systems, who've been used to the collection of masses of data, who've been the product, who've actually contributed to the product and understand it, who I think will make a big difference. And maybe that's what we need to wait for in terms of when we manage to persuade government that this is really important. But I think their signs are there. It's just that it's taking a long time.
Hmm. Is there any other point when you were going over the questions or in our conversation that you feel you'd really like to have said?
I think the part of the whole process of democracy of data, we've talked about the fact that you need good storytellers, you need good analysts, and you need good people to paint that picture. Part of data democracy is also about access. One of the things that I'm greatly concerned about is those who have adequate access, for instance, to the internet, will have access to all of that information. And you know, there are many, many examples about things like openbudget.org, for instance, a fantastic visualization of budgets, where in an instant you can understand how the money's being spent because of the pictures and the graphs that they're painting. If you don't have an adequate internet connection that's quick enough, then you're not going to be able to look at those sorts of things. And while in suburban areas and the eastern seaboard, we might say, well, look, you know, it's increasingly getting better. When you're looking at people in central Australia where, you know, connectivity is a real challenge, then I have great fears that access to the data that affects them most won't be there. And I think in terms of a democracy, it assumes in that process that everybody has equal access to that data. If you don't have access to that data in an increasingly data-driven world, then you're at a disadvantage. And that's where the data democracy, if you like, breaks down. So there's another aspect that we need to deal with, and that is access to the data itself. And I'm not sure that people understand that. I think there is an understanding that, for instance, services, council services, are increasingly going online. So it's dependent on being able to connect up. I understand that businesses now know that if you are not connected up, you are sometimes at a competitive disadvantage. But as a member of this community, I think access to information, vital information about your community and about the world you live in, or lack thereof, is a big problem. And that challenges the notion of data democracy quite significantly.
And how far have we gone along the road of equality of access?
Look, I think we've gone a fair way. I mean, I think there was a huge leap of understanding when it was decided that it wasn't good enough just to have internet access in metropolitan areas of a certain quality. And I think the advent of the National Broadband Network, regardless of political machinations around it, was a concession that the market had simply failed and that there was a very urgent need to close that digital divide because of issues like access to government data and to services and those sorts of things. So the acceptance of the fact, even through the change of governments, that an NBN must exist, I think is a huge step forward. I think we can always argue about the execution. But there is something that I'll fight for a very long time, and that is to keep the NBN in public hands. You know, we went down the track of privatising it. In my view, it didn't work. I think from now on, we need to make sure that we protect that asset as it grows and as it changes and as it evolves. And there'll be a constant vigilance to ensure that that network allows roughly equal access to all members of the community, whether you're in remote central Australia or on the eastern seaboard in a city, that you have equal access to government data and to services and those sorts of things electronically, and education and health and everything else. But as far as the data aspect is concerned, the increasing sophistication of data sets, the increasing visualization of data sets, and geospatial information is an especially good example, requires you to have at least a half decent connection to the net to make that information valuable. Take that away and the information isn't valuable and you are at a disadvantage.